Welcome to Breaking Doctrine, presented to you by the Combined Arms Doctrine Directorate at the Combined Arms Center at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. The views expressed here are those of the individual and do not represent the views of the Combined Arms Center, U.S. Army, or U.S. government.
Welcome to Breaking Doctrine, a U.S. Army Combined Arms Center podcast on emerging doctrine in the Army's vision of warfare. I'm Captain Ed Garibay, and today's topic is one that touches every part of Army life. Army jargon, terminology, and buzzwords. At some point in your military career, you've probably heard the phrase, words matter. But it's far more than just a catchphrase. Words do matter, and they form the foundation of how we communicate as an Army, from combat to the command post. Today, we'll discuss a particular paradox. While the Army's dictionary is becoming more precise, Army writing actually seems to be getting more complex and difficult to read. We'll also discuss different types of words and how they can help or harm how we write and communicate. Joining me to discuss these topics are two experts in the field, Mr. Carlos Soto, the U.S. Army's terminologist and symbologist, and Dr. Elena Wicker, an expert in military jargon, terminology, buzzwords, and the lives of military documents. Sir, ma'am, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me here.
Thank you so much for having us. I'm really excited to have this conversation.
So I'd like to jump right in and talk about this interesting paradox, not just across the Army, but the entire military, where the dictionary, the Army dictionary, seems to be getting smaller and more precise. But yet, military writing as a whole, over the last couple decades, has been getting more and more complex, which is it's kind of this interesting dynamic. Dr. Wicker, could you explain what's going on with this trend?
Yeah, so for the Army's doctrinal lexicon. I started researching military language, expecting to just see wild proliferation. I thought that, you know, over the centuries, we would just get more and more doctrinal language as we got more publications, as there was greater complexity in warfare, more technology. And I found exactly the opposite. The Army has published a dictionary on average every 2 years since 1944. And when you look at the number of terms that the Army officially recognizes and codifies, that number has been shrinking since 1944. So today, there is about 1/8 the amount of codified terminology as was in the Army Dictionary in 1944. And if you look back to those original dictionaries of like 1810, the 1810 dictionary has tens of thousands of words in it. The encyclopedia that came out of West Point in 1880 has tens of thousands of entries. It is like 100,000 pages. Today, there's quite a bit less. And I think where this comes from is from standardization, because the whole point of standardization is to remove variation and to remove options, right? So thinking of just like a simple example, if you are trying to tell someone to, you know, go left, you could say, like, move counterclockwise, right? Go to your 9 o'clock. If you're facing north, go west, right? But if doctrine says, if you are telling someone to do any of these actions, say, go left, now what was 4 options is now 1. So suddenly you have 1/4 the amount of available language to express the concept of going left. Like, there are a lot of different ways to express this idea, but once we standardize, there are fewer options and less risk of mistranslation and misunderstanding and miscommunication. So doctrine's role as laying out those best practices also limits the availability of incorrect or less accurate ways of expressing information.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people forget about doctrine's role in standardizing our language. Mr. Soto, could you elaborate on this a little bit?
The issue is that we had to create some controls so we don't have a dictionary of 10,000, 50,000 words, and then we have terms that are archaic but are still in the dictionary and no longer used, like our, you know, our allies to the north, Canada, has a dictionary, and it just keeps growing and growing and growing. Well, we didn't want that. We wanted to have those terms that we need to conduct current operations. But yes, it has reduced quite a bit, and that's on purpose.
And I think the important thing that both of you bring up is this standardization makes language more precise and more widely understood. So it seems strange that military writing suddenly has become more and more difficult to read. Dr. Wicker, could you talk about that a little bit more?
So one of the things that we have been seeing in the trends of readability in Army documents and broader national strategy, other types of government documents, is that we are seeing lower readability across these documents. There's more documents, they're more complex, and they're all getting harder to read.
Which is interesting because you hear a lot about the military writing style, which is supposed to be understood in a single rapid reading. So if language is getting more precise and we have this directive to write in a certain way, what do you think's behind these documents being so difficult to read?
So there have been several efforts to create plain language within government documents. There have been efforts to redesign the spelling of American English back in the 1970s and 1980s. There's the plain language movement. There's plain language legislation. But a lot of the metrics that are required of those documents don't actually translate to readability, which is interesting. So one of the metrics is, for example, training, right? You're trained to write with plain language. You have resources available to you, but that doesn't mean that you actually have to do it. So you can be taught best practices, but the actual act of writing in plain language, when you combine all of these other dynamics of like deference to hierarchy, if you have to say the buzzwords of the leader in this document to show deference to hierarchy, to signal that you are worthy of resources, to show that you are paying attention to the newest concept, to show that you are in line with the national security strategy, to show that you have read the national defense strategy and the national military strategy. Like, it explodes the amount of complex jargon that you have to include in a document. And I think that these pressures are becoming more and more powerful just as more and more paper moves within the Department of Defense.
It's definitely something that I think a lot of soldiers can identify with. Especially, you look, there's this renewed sense of professional military writing going on in the Army right now. And so there's a lot to kind of unpack here. There's jargon, slang, buzzwords. And so to kind of unpack this problem, let's go over what each of those are and how they affect our writing and our communication. So Mr. Soto, as the Army's terminologist, can you start us off with terminology, which is officially outlined in FM1-02.1, operational terms?
Well, Army terminology is our professional language. Every profession has a professional language, whether you're a lawyer or you're a doctor. And terminology meets the same needs for the U.S. Army as the doctor or the lawyer, so they can execute their profession in a clear and concise way. So, and our terminology is linked to our doctrine. It actually comes from our doctrine. And that terminology evolves as our doctrine evolves. It changes as our doctrine changes, and it's made for us to be able to communicate more effectively.
I completely agree. Something that I often like to mention is when I'm talking to folks who are trying to think about their writing is the difference between jargon and terminology. Because often they are lumped together in a lot of writing guidance, and they serve slightly different functions. And slang is another category that also serves a useful set of functions in the Army, like as a community. But for jargon, like jargon is any word that means something specific to the Army and doesn't have an immediately apparent meaning to someone who's not in the Army. But typically we talk about jargon and it's very negative, but it exists for these very functional reasons. And then terminology is actually just like a subset of jargon that has gone through all the official processes to become a part of doctrine, it is what has been fully standardized. So there is a lot of jargon that has not been fully standardized, whereas terminology is that set that has gone through all of those appropriate procedures. And both have a place in professional writing, in my opinion, especially because most conversations about Army topics require technical knowledge, and they require the technical language to express that knowledge. But neither works. Like, neither terminology nor jargon will work unless both parties, both writer and reader, understand exactly what that word means. So they do have a place. Jargon is your kind of key to the space and to the discourse, and terminology is the connection into the existing written record of Army best practice. And then slang is much more colloquial. Typically, it's just written far less than jargon or terminology. It's a way to kind of build community. It has a lot of social purposes. But another category that I would add to this conversation is abbreviations and acronyms, because those show up in writing all the time. And the Army has a lot of acronyms, but it actually does not have the most acronyms of all the services. And so we use acronyms and we say acronyms and they become habit, but in writing they actually cause a number of challenges. And my favorite comment, actually from the Navy terminologist, is that acronyms help the writer, not the reader. So spelling out an acronym or writing out jargon in plain language just always takes more words. It will always require more words, and so it will increase your word count. So if you use more acronyms, you lower your word count, but you actually damage people's ability to understand what you're writing. So it's a trade-off between, you know, the functionality of the document that you're creating and the fact that you're actually going to damage how well people can understand what you're writing. But acronyms are such a common part of the Army lexicon, and there are certainly a lot of them.
The problem I have is that acronyms are, again, acronyms, I'm not saying acronyms are not useful, but the problem I have with acronyms is it creates a language that we all say, well, I think I know what that means, but I'm not sure, but I'm not going to say anything because I don't want to look stupid. So I'm gonna keep my mouth shut, and I'm just going to shake my head and say yes. So that further dilutes the language. So are we helping better understand what we are reading, or are we just confusing? And in the long run, it's a cliche when you say it, but are we creating another Tower of Babel using more acronyms and more acronyms?
If I may, you touch on what I think is one of the most dangerous dynamics in military professional language, and that is this like guild effect of, if you can speak the language, then you're showing that you're competent, right? So language and acronyms and jargon become a proxy for your competence in your job. And so if you admit that you don't know what an acronym stands for or you don't know what jargon means, then it becomes like you're saying that you don't know how to do your job. So nobody will ask what the acronym stands for, what the jargon means, because it is seen as this, you know, mark that you don't know what the conversation's about. And it's so dangerous because it embeds misunderstandings and it embeds lack of understanding, because it is very rare for people to expand their acronyms as they talk or to explain their jargon as they talk. And I think that this is one of those areas where leaders play a big role, because if a leader is willing to ask what something stands for or what it means, or ask someone to explain that jargon, then it creates a space where other people can ask about the jargon or about the acronyms.
Exactly. You shouldn't feel guilty to ask somebody what that means. You shouldn't feel inferior. And I can tell you, 26 years in the Army, and I did that. I would not ask because I didn't want to show weakness, didn't want to show that I wasn't bright enough as that. And little did I know that most of the people that put acronyms up there on a briefing sometimes, and I've seen it because now I ask, what does that mean? They said, well, let me get back to you. It empowers individuals, soldiers, officers, and civilians to ask. There shouldn't be a power struggle of I know more than you in this language, and this is a secret language that I know, and you better learn my language.
I think it's really important that both of you bring up the role of the leader in communication, because in the Army, it really does set the standard when a senior leader writes or talks in a certain way, because if that's overly complex, then the junior leader is going to think that's the way I need to do it as well. And like you both said, jargon isn't necessarily bad. It's just finding the right mix of jargon and terminology for the audience that you're trying to communicate with to do so in a clear way. And with that, I'd kind of like to shift gears and talk about slang real quick. So Mr. Soto, in your opinion, is there room for this type of informal language in professional writing?
In my opinion, we should use our professional language because that is meant to create the clarity we need to do whatever it is that we are going to execute. But I understand slang is used. I used it when I was in Iraq as a lieutenant colonel, and I used it with the soldiers. But those are unique situations where you know each other very well, so you understand what that slang means. The problem is when you use that slang and somebody from another organization or another country hears you say that, and then they misinterpret what you're saying, or they don't understand totally what you're saying. And I'm talking about, you know, it could be an Australian. I'm not talking about someone who speaks a different language, but someone who speaks English from another country might not understand that slang. And one that I used before when I was in Germany as a captain, we used to use, we're going to shellac the enemy, okay? Well, shellac, again, it could be misinterpreted. What do we mean by that? Destroy, defeat, or just we're going to paint the enemy with a coat of shine that's going to make them stand out. So these are the reasons why we have to make sure that we minimize that. I understand there are places in small teams and small organizations where it's effective communication. But if we're going to write an operations order or we're going to mission statement, and it isn't just my opinion, it's the correct way is to use proper professional language. I remember there was an instance in Gettysburg where the Southern forces were pushing towards Gettysburg. And Robert E. Lee told General Ewell, "You see that hill up there? If practicable, I want you to take and capture it." Well, guess what? The general didn't capture it. And that became what we call the fish hook, the eye of the fish hook, that helped the Union forces pretty much defeat the Southern forces. And that wasn't an effective way to communicate. That's what we want to avoid. We want effective communication where there is no question what we mean because it's supported by doctrine. It's supported by lessons learned. So that's what we're looking for. And only effective, clear language provides that professional language. And again, and it doesn't have to be defined professional language because we have many descriptive terms that are described in our doctrine and they're not defined. But as long as we use the professional language and not the slang, I believe we'll be more effective in what we do as an Army.
So to go back to your story about Gettysburg, even nowadays with communicating orders, it's difficult. And so to imagine a time when you didn't have standardized language, it's almost perplexing to think of how many battlefield miscommunications there were. And it's kind of interesting because that's the reason why the Army Dictionary came about in the first place. Dr. Wicker, could you talk about that?
Yeah, it's actually one of my favorite discoveries when I was working on this research was finding that during World War II, the military actually partnered with the WPA, with the Works Progress Administration, to stand up the Military Dictionary Project to produce dictionaries. And this was because apparently there's a couple of references to this in like the archival record. During the evacuation at Dunkirk, there was a mistranslation of where reinforcements were supposed to go, so where people were supposed to move. and that French to English and English to French translation wasn't precise. And so apparently people went to the wrong place, and this ended up causing a lot of casualties. So that was one episode. And then the lack of fully standardized command language led to just in English, commands were being given and they weren't being fully understood. So we have a couple of episodes of like mistranslation at Dunkirk, multilingual mistranslation, and then you have the mistranslation of commands in English. And so the Army realized that they needed to start standardizing translation in particular, especially when working with allies. And there was already a focus on standardization of material and of materiel, but there was a new focus on language. So they stood up the Military Dictionary Project, and they started delivering translation dictionaries by 1941. They were publishing English-German translation dictionaries, English-French, Italian, and a couple of other languages. But they almost immediately recognized that they needed just a translation dictionary that translated American military to American English, because there was a lot of misunderstanding over what these terms meant. So by 1944, this military dictionary project had published the first official technical manual on Army terminology. And now, since that project, there has been on average a new Army dictionary published every 2 years. So historically, it was certainly taken for granted that military terminology needed to be explained, and we get this through the scattered dictionaries through the 1800s. But it's World War II operational failures, casualties, that they realized that they actually needed to start actively standardizing. And that was kind of the beginning of this almost century of terminology standardization that we've seen so far.
And I think all those stories really drive home the point of the importance of communication. And so we've talked about terminology, we've talked about jargon, slang, but there's one other subset of words that we really need to discuss, and that's buzzwords, because they really are in a category all their own. There's a social aspect to them, and I think a lot of people have this love-hate relationship with them as well. So could you talk about buzzwords and how they come about and what's their impact?
Yeah, absolutely. So buzzwords come about because they are an attempt to create change. And for the Army, a lot of this happens in an organizational context, because language has a lot of very important operational functions, but it also has a lot of institutional and organizational roles that it plays. And so sometimes it seems like there's this flippancy with language about creating new terms, you know, creating the next exciting word that the Army has to get behind and adapt to. And often that first look, it doesn't become clear exactly how the meaning is different from something that already exists. But sometimes the reasoning behind introducing that term doesn't really have to do with meaning. It has something to do with the organization. And so buzzwords can help organizations, and especially a large organization like the Army, you know, shift ways of thinking, or importantly, shift resources as well. So sometimes people will be using a word to show that they're paying attention to leadership, because leaders have stated a new priority, and so all of their subordinates, all of those subordinate organizations are gonna say, we are listening, we are now paying attention to this priority, and we are doing this in order to support what you want us to do. And so it happens in hierarchical organizations. Another element of this is that when resources get attached, using the term, using the buzzword, justifies your continued distribution of resources. So if you contribute to that thing, then you deserve the resources that you have. So it's social and structural, it's material. And sometimes those buzzwords are truly new concepts, new ideas. And so using the term is actually a real shift in framework or shift in thought. But there are organizational reasons to introduce buzzwords, and there are strategies that you can use to maximize the effectiveness of buzzwords. they have really interesting organizational purposes that go far beyond the, you know, common conception that they're just to, you know, get a gold star because you've introduced a new idea or get that, you know, good mark in your record for having introduced something something new.
So you mentioned how buzzwords can be used for signaling. And I think it's really interesting how people will use buzzwords and tack them onto phrases where they don't necessarily belong in the interest of signaling. And so a good example is multi-domain, which the Army has multi-domain operations, which is the Army's operational concept. But people will use multi-domain almost like a buzzword in and of itself. And so rather than just doing a regular attack, they're now doing a multi-domain attack. Rather than having field feeding, they've got multi-domain field feeding, which is nonsensical. But, you know, it really is kind of fascinating how people will use buzzwords in a way that causes confusion rather than clarity in the name of signaling.
No, well, that's good you brought that up because the problem is people think that just by adding it, okay, we have multi-domain sustainment operations, you know, multi-domain operations. For this, for that, multi-domain is specifically has a place and a meaning, and you just placing it in something doesn't make it multi-domain because you don't have the capabilities to execute multi-domain. So you have to have certain capabilities. It's just not a word or term that empowers you to do things if you don't have those capabilities. And so that's the issue.
One of the jokes that I heard about multi-domain operations was that at AUSA, after the concept was released, that suddenly you had multi-domain on everything and you got the multi-domain canteen cup. So it became this bumper sticker that was stuck onto everything. But when you think about it in terms of the organizational ramifications of what happens if you don't contribute to multi-domain operations, like it becomes very clear that it's an organizational survival strategy to take the term and then apply it to everything. And I think why concepts in particular are interesting is that, first of all, buzzwords are a tool to help concept writers or actually really to help leaders move the United States Army in a different direction. But because concepts are not doctrine, those terms sometimes have not gone through the same standardization processes that we get for our doctrinal terminology. And doctrinal terminology has to be things that we can do now. And if a concept is supposed to describe how we fight in 15 years, then maybe we can't do that yet. So that word is out there as something that is necessary, but we can't yet do. So there's still some flexibility in what it ends up meaning by the time it makes it into doctrine. And so everybody can attempt to shape it a little bit in the way that will, that in the way that they see, you know, the future of the Army going. But it's a moment where they can still be shaped. They can still be shaped, but they are also shaping the Army. So there's a lot more contention over those words than I think in some other doctrinal publications.
Yeah, and I think it's great, Ibrahim. It's a tool for the leader, but it's risky. And I think you assume the most risk when you're not clear in how you're using it, especially if it's not something formal like a concept. If you're unclear in how you're using whatever it is that you're creating this kind of rally cry, people can run with it and turn it into something very, very different. But I want to shift gears again real quick because we've talked about a number of different types of words and how their use or misuse can complicate language. And one of the big arguments is that warfare is just getting more complicated. And that's why our documents are getting more complicated as well. And you see this in the 2000s, where this shift in counterinsurgency is called graduate level warfare. And so now all of our writing also has to be at the graduate level. In recent times, we've been trying to reverse that and bring it back to the level where it's more understandable to the wide audience and not written at such a high level. So I guess my question is, just because warfare is more complex, does that mean that our writing has to be as well?
By talking about warfare as if it is this abstract, complex concept, sometimes it unconsciously gives us this free pass to use vague language. Because it's this idea that it's so complex, in the name of this more advanced approach to warfare, we just have to use more complex language. And I don't think that that is necessarily the case. Jargon already makes it easier for us to not explain ourselves, because every piece of jargon is a shortcut to a more complex concept. And if we never explain our jargon, then we are never forced to explain those more complex concepts. And so translating that complex thought into simple language is not easy to do, but it is necessary. So it is really hard to translate complex ideas into simple language, but simple language doesn't mean simple ideas. You can take complexity and break it down into something that's understandable. It just takes a lot of work, and it takes focus. And the more that we do it, the better we get at it. But I think that's one of the fundamental roles of especially doctrine, right? Like, professional journals are having these debates. They are thinking about what the future is going to look like, what we might need to be able to do. But doctrine has to be taught. Doctrine has to be learned. So it has to be understandable. And so that translation is just something that we have to develop the skills to do.
And I agree with what you just said. I would like to add, though, the more complex the doctrine, usually the more terms, defined terms that we add. The less complex, sometimes there are books that don't have any defined terms in them. And if we follow our best practices of the past for terminology, when we create complex doctrine, then we'll have to create associated terminology, defined terminology, so they can better understand that complex warfare doctrine that's out there. I believe if we write the doctrine in a way that it's clear and concise and understandable and has supporting lexicon to understand it, it doesn't matter how complex the battlefield might be, we'll find a way to understand it.
So we've talked a lot about challenges, but how are some of the ways we can improve our professional writing and discourse?
Well, in order to improve our language, is first off, we have to be careful that we're making changes in our language because it's going to help us better understand something. My problem as a terminologist is when we create definitions that really sometimes are confusing and really I don't understand what you mean by it. And sometimes I say, okay, I kind of get it, but kind of get it for me is not good enough. It should be, I read that definition, just like I go to Webster's and I read the definition, and I said, oh, I know what that is. But I feel that that is a problem. We should make sure that that definition, if I read it, or if you read it, you understand specifically what that means, and you don't have to go look up because it has the reference, it has a source there. You said, well, okay, that's a source. Let me go there and read the whole thing, because that's not what a definition is. A definition is telling you precisely what that is. And somebody will say, well, we'll fix it later. Yeah, we'll get to that. Well, that's fine, but let's do it now if we can. But that's the only thing I could say.
So in order to improve like individual use of language, I think we have to take a more active role in thinking about how we write. And part of this is that it's really easy to rely on habit. And there are a lot of cognitive biases associated with language that make it hard for us to identify what types of language we're using at any one time. So things like the curse of expertise or the curse of knowledge, where we don't have the ability to naturally understand where our background knowledge comes from. And we assume that other people share that same background knowledge. Army language is particularly challenging because the number of professions within the Army, there's a lot of them. And there are people in the Army who do everything from, like, my favorite comparison is the Army has bandmasters and the Army has astronauts. and they require different language to do their jobs. And so even when we're just thinking about what is Army and what is standard English, there's a lot of variation within just the armies that speaking between different communities is really challenging. So what we have to do is we have to become much more active in thinking about and looking at the language that we're using. And once you start looking at it, it becomes so much more easy to recognize it. If you're going through a section of Army writing and trying to identify everything that is specific to the Army, you probably will not get all of it on a first pass. But the more that you practice and the more that you think about it, the more that you look for it, the more that you're like, huh, I have worked in this specific community, therefore, when I write about that community, I need to look even more closely at the language that I'm using because there's probably more jargon. Like, doing that actively will build the muscles that you need to then do it reflexively. So it does take work, but it is absolutely doable. But I think that the biggest thing is you have to be able to recognize that all of your cognitive biases that are telling you that you are talking in a normal way, like in a standard English way, they're all of those biases are lying to you. And as soon as you accept that, you can start to recognize the jargon and make active choices. Because like we've been saying, sometimes jargon is the right choice. Because sometimes you need to have a professional conversation that relies on professional technical knowledge that can be expressed in this Army jargon, this Army terminology, and then you need it. But you should be actively choosing to use it, not just using it out of habit with the unconscious assumption that everyone else is going to understand it, because that is not always the case, and it's potentially not even the case within the Army, given the amount of fragmentation and the number of dialects that we have within just the Army, much less trying to speak from within the Army to a joint community or to a broader audience. So my main recommendation is just to take that active role, accept the fact that we all use a large amount of jargon, and then start to take steps to learn how to recognize it. And then once you can recognize it, you can choose whether or not to use it.
And don't unnecessarily use buzzwords if you don't have to.
Yes.
Now, so I appreciate you both. Any final words as we wrap up the podcast?
No, I mean, I believe this was a very good discussion. Language is ever changing. It's ever evolving. The Army lexicon will continue to evolve it. So it's just making sure that as it does, it's done to better understand the supporting doctrine and for us to be able to communicate more effectively and not done just for the sake of doing it.
I guess my final thought would just be, we often talk about the Army's legacy of excellence in land warfare, but that is often an operational conversation. And I think it is important to remember the institutional factors that make those operational successes possible. So one of those enablers that is often taken for granted is doctrine, and even more so, terminology and language. And doctrine is, you know, setting the standards for training. It is recording best practice. It is how we incorporate lessons learned into the next generation of doctrine. It plays a really important role in creating the basis of knowledge that then makes operations possible and operations more successful. And as much as we joke about acronyms and buzzwords, like, this is actually an area that the Army has a real historical record of excellence in maintaining. And we certainly take it for granted. And as we are thinking about the future of warfare, we can't forget about the language component, because we can't have commands mistranslated in, you know, 2041 like they were mistranslated in 1941. And this is something that we've recognized is a challenge. And the Army has set up the structures required to correct that and to build the lexicon that's needed to make sure that communication can happen clearly. And it's often overlooked, but I think it's something that we all have to hold ourselves accountable to, in a way. Like recognizing what we're doing, the language that we're using, starting to pay more attention to the words that we're using, asking questions when jargon doesn't make sense or when you don't know what an acronym stands for, you know, and ultimately thinking a little bit more carefully about the words that we choose to use.
Well, thank you both so much for the great conversation and for being a part of Breaking Doctrine. Just like Writing New Doctrine is a team effort, Breaking Doctrine takes a team. Without the crew and Special Doctrine Division here at CAD, we wouldn't be able to bring you this show. Don't forget to subscribe on YouTube, Apple, Audible, and Spotify podcasts. And follow us on social media at U.S. Army Doctrine to get updates on new podcasts, Doctrine Digest videos, and publications. Finally, the views and opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the official position of the United States Army, U.S. Army Training and Doctrine Command, or Combined Arms Center. I'm Captain Ed Garibay, and this has been Breaking Doctrine.